I'm going to invite Emma Lentz to come forward to light our chalice. I can't see. There she is. And as she does, I want to invite us all to think of what we've learned from people of other faith traditions. As Emma lights our chalice this morning, I'd like to think of this flame that she kindles as a flame in honor of all that we've learned from brothers and sisters of faith in the Jewish tradition, in the Christian tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, and yes, perhaps especially also as we honor Catholicism today, I'm also mindful of our need to honor those of the Muslim faith as well this morning. So let us, as we begin this celebration of life, this worship service this morning, bring to mind and heart with gratitude those who have taught us the life of compassion, a life of meaning, a life of purpose from their faith, tradition, and perspective. For the bounty of those gifts, we light our chalice flame, showing us the way to respect and hope for people of all faiths. So may it be.
For any other children who'd like to come forward, it would be wonderful to have you here. Now, something that, as you're walking up, I'll tell you, I was very surprised recently to learn something new about the Vatican. Do you know what the Vatican is, anybody? Any of you small people? It's kind of the center of the Catholic Church. And outside the Vatican, lots of tourists go to the Vatican, as well as all the Pope and the people who work at the church. And so when the tourists come, you know, some of them like to bring home a trinket, a little souvenir. And so there are people outside the Vatican with their booths set up, selling statues of Jesus and of the Virgin Mary and rosary beads for Christian prayer. And almost all of them are Jewish. It's been going on for centuries. It's interesting, isn't it? And I just wanted to preamble my story with that because my story is also about a connection between Christians and Jews. Way up high in a valley surrounded by forest was a beautiful old stone building. And a couple hundred years ago, that stone building was bustling with activity. There must have been 100, maybe even 200 monks who lived there. And they were busy doing good work and helping the needy and looking after the monastery. But at the time of this story, there were only, a couple of handfuls of monks. And they were very busy. How could they keep up the good work? And how could they help the needy? And how could they look after their beloved monastery? They were worried. And they were getting old, too. And they wondered what would happen when they were gone. There were no young monks. With all this worry, those monks were having trouble, smiling very much. They were just consumed by, oh, no, what if? Oh, no. And so when visitors came, they didn't feel very comfortable there. There was this tense atmosphere, and so they didn't stay long. One of the people who was the most worried was, of course, the head monk, the abbot, and he really didn't know what to do. There was a little hut not far from the monastery, and this happened to be a retreat place for the local rabbis from the villages nearby. And there was one rabbi in particular who was a very wise man. And so when the abbot heard that he was visiting that shelter, he decided to go and say hello. Well, he knocked at the door, and the rabbi welcomed him in, sit down, have tea, and the abbot couldn't stop himself. Immediately he began to tell about his worries. What's going to happen to the monastery? Nobody comes. Nobody stays. And the rabbi said, oh, I understand. Most Fridays, the synagogue is almost empty. I don't know what to do either. So they spent the evening just visiting, just keeping each other company. And at the end of the evening, as the abbot got up to go, the rabbi said, "But there is one thing you should tell your monks. Don't discuss it, but tell them that there is one amongst you who is truly holy." Truly holy. Oh. Well, the abbot walked home. He was kind of curious about this, and he went home, and it was time for evening prayers, and after the monks had all prayed together, he told them what the rabbi had said. He said, "We mustn't talk about it, but you must know that one amongst us is truly holy." Well, over the next days, the monks were all a little distracted. They thought about, well, Brother Elias, he's so cranky. Couldn't be him. But he can fix anything. Maybe it is him. Brother Thomas, he's so dreamy. Couldn't be him. But he always has a kind word. Maybe it is him. And they thought about each of the brothers that way, and then each of them in their own time came to themselves. It couldn't be me. What if it is? And as soon as they thought that thought, it caused them to gasp a little, to breathe in, and oh, their hearts felt a little warmer. And you know, after that, they were standing a little more upright. They were standing taller, and they were smiling more and looking at each other, and it really changed that monastery. Visitors, when they came now, well, they felt the warmth of the place, and they wanted to stay, and there were even some young monks who signed up. Things changed completely. It's kind of amazing. A miracle, as simple as that. And the thing is, we all have that miracle inside us. And when the adults sing you out at the end of the, with the arches, they're actually trying to remind you of that.
Join me now in that place of reverent honesty. That place of depth and meaning. That place of prayer and meditation. Spirit of life and of love, known to us by many names. Each week, as we look at these candles, something is kindled within us. These candles of life and loss. These candles of worry and hope. These candles that lift up both what is happening in our own individual lives and what we worry about in our larger world. Sometimes, Great Spirit, when we see these candles, we think of all of the other candles lit the world over. Candles lit in synagogues, in temples, in mosques, in parish churches, in cathedrals. Small flames and huge pillars of light. Whatever language that prayer was offered in, whatever temple or cathedral or mosque in which it was uttered, that light, that same light, that light of shared hope and life and loss and remembrance is the world over. Would that we could remember that common ground more often. that our lights are the same. Now, in this full moment of silence, I invite you to think not only in your own heart of what you would light a candle for today, what you did light a candle for today, but to kindle in yourself as well a candle of peace, a candle of understanding, a candle of hope in our silent togetherness. So may it be.
I grew up in a small town, Ketch Harbor, Nova Scotia. It had one church, a Roman Catholic church. I was baptized Anglican, and my family wasn't religious. So unlike many people in the community, we slept in on Sunday mornings. I heard from the other kids in the neighborhood how they had to go to catechism every Sunday afternoon as well. They didn't like it much, but when they told me about the stories and the things that they learned there, I wanted to go too. I don't remember the conversation exactly, but when I asked my mom if I could go to catechism, she told me that it wasn't for me. And the decision was made, even though in my heart I still wanted to learn those stories that the other kids told me about. So when the bookmobile came down our road, I took out a book of Bible stories. I treasured that book. To me, it seemed that I held onto it forever. I think I might have even taken it out twice in a row. It was a big book, and I read it from cover to cover. And it was stories about the Golden Rule, since upgraded to the Platinum Rule by Reverend Melora, the Good Samaritan, and the Poor Woman's Offering. Stories about Jesus, of how he showed respect and kindness to all, and how he washed the leper's feet, and how he treated a prostitute with the same regard as he did all of his other followers. I took those Bible stories to heart, and they've been my guide throughout my life. In fact, I believe they were the beginnings of the UU path I now follow. So now when we talk about religious diversity and what we have in common with other religions, I think of these stories and how they help form the principles I now hold dear. How they and other teachings like them must have had the same influence on many other people's lives, devoted Christian and Unitarian Universalists alike. I believe that such ethics form the basis of many, if not all, religious and spiritual practices, whether it's through the comfort and stability of a belief system handed down through generations, or through insight gained by personal searching and discovery, the goals of becoming our best selves and doing our part to make the world a better place for all are the same. And so I think, are we really all that different? Aren't we all just trying to do the best that we can with the life that we've been given? The Dalai Lama says, people take different roads seeking fulfillment and happiness. Just because they're not on the road, on your road, doesn't mean that they've gotten lost.
I woke up this morning and I thought, I wonder how many people want to hear what a Unitarian Universalist minister has to say about Pope Francis. Evidently, the answer is quite a few. You can thank Barbara Nyland for this topic at last spring's service auction when asked what sermon she would like me to deliver. She said she would like me to talk about the Pope. I got in touch with Barbara again this week and I said, anything in particular? He's said a lot of stuff lately. And she said, no, I just want to hear what you think of him. That's a dangerous offer right there. So what I think of him is what you will hear a little bit this morning. And I guess I would begin just by saying he's a fascinating character. I encourage you. I spent a lot of time reading New Yorker articles and Rolling Stone articles and all kinds of things about him. And there are, of course, whole books about him now, biographies, that I recommend giving a little look to him. The reading this morning is a very brief excerpt from Pope Francis himself, a speech that he delivered in November of 2013. The title was in Italian, but I'm going to anglicize it for us, which was The Joy of the Gospel. And many people see this speech that he delivered as sort of his mission statement for what the Catholic Church should be about. Just a few paragraphs from him. I prefer a church which is bruised, hurting, and dirty because it has been out on the streets, rather than a church which is unhealthy from being confined and from clinging to its own security. I do not want a church concerned with being at the center and then ends up being caught up in a web of obsessions and procedures. More than by fear of going astray, my hope is that we will be moved by the fear of remaining shut up within structures which give us a false sense of security, within rules which make us harsh judges, within habits which make us feel safe, while at our door people are starving, and Jesus does not tire of saying to us, give them something to eat. To say that Pope Francis has caused a stir and lots of speculation and opinion, both within and beyond the Catholic Church, would be an understatement. He hasn't been Pope for 2 years yet. Did you realize this? He was just elected Pope on March 13th of 2013. And yet, in this short period of time, he has said so many things that have led many to wonder just what sort of impact and legacy his papacy will leave behind. Before I say more about what my interpretation of the Pope's words has led me to in terms of where I think he may lead the Catholic Church, let me back up and try to offer at least a little bit of perspective. The first has to do with this balancing act of tradition and history on the one hand and sort of modernism and contemporary trends on the other. You see, I think that it's not just in Catholicism, but in all religious traditions that there is this continual conversation and debate about the balance, what the appropriate balance is between history and tradition on one side and the contemporary or sort of vanguard leanings of the moment, the forming edge of things, if you will. Too often, I think this is presented as an either or. We must either completely jettison tradition and history in order to reach today's masses, or only tradition matters and we must cling to everything historical, everything, as the Pope's reading would make you think, all of our structures and everything that we have in place. We see this kind of either or as either the fads and the whims of the current moment will take over and sweep through us and we will forget what we are and where we're about, those timeless truths of our tradition, or that the current moment will overcome us. And yet, it seems to me we don't seem to think as much about the fact that sometimes those current moment fads, if you will become tomorrow's timeless truths. Sometimes those new ways of doing things will just open up some long-standing traditions and doctrine and make them feel more current and more helpful rather than limiting. The truth, as much for us Unitarian Universalists as for Catholics, is that there is much in value in history and tradition, without which we become quite simply lost and untethered. We don't know who we are, why we're here, and the unique elements and historical figures of our particular story that have shaped us into being who we are today. And so it seems to me that Pope Francis is, in a way, trying to figure out that balance between tradition and modernity. In some ways, you could also say that Pope Francis and the current questions about what direction he is going to move the Catholic Church in are similar to some of the conversations that came up around Vatican II. I did a little reading about Vatican II this week, and it was quite interesting. That Second Vatican Council, which was from 1962 to 1965, was seen as different from previous councils because it didn't issue any new dogmas, it didn't settle any current heresies of that time in the early 60s. Rather, it made some other changes in the Church. Perhaps the ones most remembered are it shifted from always having Latin Mass to Mass in the vernacular, and changed the music a little bit of the Catholic Church so they weren't always singing Be Thou My Vision like we did this morning. In fact, some people think there's a real link between Pope Francis and Vatican II, because in that document that I shared some of with you this morning, the people he cited repeatedly were the two popes involved in Vatican II. Well, let's move now to Pope Francis, now that we have him a little bit in context. In the many articles that I read about the Pope, there seem to be two schools of thought on what he is doing, or on what he is not doing, depending on who you ask. One school of thought is that he is a breath of fresh air, and that all he has said thus far in his almost 2 years of being Pope, and all that he has done, augurs the kind of broad and far-reaching doctrinal changes which will be at least as significant as Vatican II, if not even more so. Those people say that he is about to profoundly change the Catholic Church. Now, the second school of thought disagrees pretty deeply with that. The second school of thought is that Pope Francis is changing the tone of the Catholic Church, presenting the same doctrine and the same dogma in kinder, gentler, even more inclusive language, but with no intention of making any substantive change. The changes, these writers observe, and observers argue, is more of a pastoral tone than a prophetic change. I suppose you could even say that there's a third argument that you could see in all of these interpretations of the Pope, and that third contention would be that a change in tone is a substantial change. That it matters how we say things, not just what we say. And in that respect, the Pope would be making some big and significant changes, whether he changes any doctrine or not, in the years to come. So which of these three perspectives that I've just lifted up is most accurate? Well, time will tell. But since I was asked to share my thoughts about the Pope, again, a very dangerous thing for Barbara to do, I will say that if I had to wager, and I'm not really a bettor, I would guess that he will make some doctrinal changes, but not as many as some suspect or hope that he will right now. And I agree with that third contention, that the change in tone and the change in the focus of the Catholic Church will itself be a significant change, regardless of how much doctrinal change he makes. I'll tell you just a little bit about the Pope, because I think in order to really see him, you have to do a little bit of understanding how it is this guy came to be Pope. The Pope, as you may know, is 78 years old. He's Argentinian, born to parents who were both Italian. Jorge Mario Bergoglio is his name. He became a priest in 1969 after brief jobs prior to seminary as both a chemical technician and, my personal favorite, a nightclub bouncer. very important to the papacy, I bet, now, right? He then became the Archbishop of Buenos Aires in 1998 and became a cardinal, elevated to cardinal in 2001 by Pope John Paul II. His election as Pope brought many firsts with it. As some of you may recall, when he was elected, he is the first Jesuit Pope. He is the first Pope from the Americas. He is the first from the Southern Hemisphere, and the first non-European Pope in 1,272 years. So with all of those firsts, perhaps he was bound to bring a different lens and a different sense of mission and vision to his papacy. Those who have known him longest and seen his ministry throughout his life have said that three commitments have always been at the heart of his work. Number one, humility. I think you can see that in the way that he is living as Pope. I'll get into that a little bit in a moment. Two, his concern for the poor, which he lifts up again and again and again. And three, he has always emphasized a vision of dialogue as a bridge between people and across difference. So he's always been a peace builder. Now, let's get into some of what the Pope has said, shall we? Yeah? Now, the Pope has made many statements which have startled and delighted people with the honesty and the forthrightness with which he has spoken. He has also made statements that make clear where he upholds the traditional doctrinal perspective. So he's been, you know, kind of cutting edge on some things, but he's also been pretty, you know, toeing the line on some things. So where is he toeing the line? On the one hand, he has continued to uphold the pro-life stance of the Catholic Church against abortion in all cases as non-negotiable and at the core of Catholic doctrine. He has also ruled out ordination of women, so I wouldn't be talking to you, and he has spoken about same-sex marriage as a threat to the family unit and is firmly opposed to same-sex marriage. So Pope and I would not get along on several points here. He even fairly recently, when he went to the Philippines and talked a lot about the family, I could have done a whole sermon on what he said about the family, so I'm just touching very briefly on this. He even said that spanking children is fine as long as you don't demean the child's dignity. So all of these views that the Pope has lifted up in some of his statements align quite clearly with the most traditional stances of the Catholic Church. Now, on the other hand, this is where he's so complicated and fascinating, he's also made many statements that seem to lean in the opposite direction on some other issues. You'll remember he was flying home from Brazil after being at this youth conference when he was directly asked about gay priests. And this Pope, who I just told you is against same-sex marriage, when he was asked about gay priests, said, and I quote, "Who am I to judge a gay person of goodwill who seeks the Lord?" He says this in Italian when he's answering the question. "You can't marginalize these people," he said, end quote. And when he was pushed to talk about how the church will respond to core societal issues like contraception, abortion, and same-sex marriage, he responded, and I quote, "I see the church as a field hospital after battle. It is useless to ask a seriously injured person if he has high cholesterol and about the level of his blood sugars. You have to heal his wounds. Then we can talk about everything else." End quote. Now, this seems to imply that care for the person comes first, and that differences of perspective or opinion should take a back seat to the well-being of the individual before you. He has on many occasions critiqued putting dogma before love and prioritizing moral doctrine over serving the poor and the marginalized. He has chosen to live in the Vatican guest house rather than the fancy papal apartment, which he thinks is too isolated. He said, when asked about that decision, and I quote, "I cannot live without people." Time and again, this is a pope who seems to put people, real lives, and especially those who are poor and marginalized, at the center of the church and what it should be about. In a scathing speech that he made to the Curia just before Christmas, maybe a lot of you heard about this, he really took the hierarchy of the church to task. And I quote from a newspaper article about that speech. Pope Francis excoriated the Vatican bureaucracy, saying that some of the cardinals, bishops, and priests who run the Roman Catholic Church suffer from a spiritual Alzheimer's. Francis warned against what he called a lust for power, hypocritical double lives, and the lack of spiritual empathy among some men of God. He listed the 15 ailments and temptations that weaken their service to the Lord, inviting them to a, quote, true self-examination, end quote. He criticized the administration that runs the Holy See for a narcissistic pathology of power, end quote. Whew, yeah. Can you imagine? You show up, you're like, oh, it's Christmas time. We're going to go hear what the Pope has to say. You just imagine what that room must have just gotten really quiet really quickly. He took them to task. Now, just to round out his exceptional statements, after the Paris shootings, he said that free speech is not a right to insult the faith of others. He told a boy whose dog had just died that one day we will see our animals again in the eternity of Christ. Paradise is open to all of God's creatures, he said, end quote. Whew! Now this is just a small sample of his statements. And each week that passed, I thought about how prescient Barbara was to ask me to preach this sermon and about how generous the Pope was for offering me so much material. This is a good and generous Pope, my friends. So how could I possibly summarize the Pope and his papacy, given what I have told you of everything that he has said thus far? And again, he hasn't even been Pope for 2 years yet. How do I possibly predict the course of his papacy? I think if, as all indications thus far would suggest, he continues in his push to make Catholicism more focused on love and service and the poor, then much will change in the practice of Catholicism, whether or not doctrine or hierarchy change at all. I should say as well that the Catholic Church has always had a powerful charitable arm and strands of the faith that have put justice work first. This is not new. You may remember that I mentioned several sermons ago, I talked some with the kids about Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker movement in New York, Catholic Charities, which gives millions and millions of dollars to help the poor, and Latin American liberation theology, which I think has also probably influenced the Pope, even though he has kind of pushed against it a little bit as well. But he grew up in Buenos Aires, looking at the slums, working in the slums, hearing this Latin American liberation theology, which says that God is on the side of the poor and the oppressed. So how could he not be, at least in some ways, moved by that and changed by that? So this change in emphasis of the church is a change that perhaps will de-emphasize power and hierarchy and money in the Catholic Church and put the focus back where, I mean, that's where that Pope, that speech just gets me. He's basically said to the Holy See, you guys are all about you. And that's not what this job is supposed to be about, right? That is what he took them to task for. You're supposed to be about helping poor people, and you're sitting here living in these nice fancy houses, not doing anything that was supposed to be at the root of why you started this job in the first place. You became a priest to love the people, especially the people on the margins. And that's what he keeps saying. Again and again and again. So what feels so new and refreshing to me about this pope is the acknowledgement that while there are some core elements of tradition that he still sees as immutable, that even those things, even those elements which some people disagree with him on and can have opposing ideas about, can be worked through if indeed you put people first, if indeed you put love as one of the most precious things that the church can offer. One of the people who interviewed the pope first when he became pope was a man by the name of Father Anthony Spadaro. And he left that interview and was quoted as saying that the pope represented a big vision, not a big shift. I believe, friends, that a big vision can be a big shift. A big vision can change a great deal. Not everything. Catholicism will still be Catholicism with its rituals and its structure and its adherence to Scripture. And for the most part, this is as it should be as far as I'm concerned. It would seem that big vision was longed for and is now being embraced. So whatever our experiences or thoughts about Catholicism and its doctrine, I hope that in seeing some of what the new pope is bringing to the table, that we might be open to this new vision that he has of love before dogma and the poor and marginalized before doctrine. For we too cannot live without people. I want to close by just making a little side statement about our own Unitarian history and how this fits in with the pope. We don't have the kind of doctrine and dogma that the Catholic Church has, but we have our own rich history, our own forefathers and foremothers who point in the direction of what our tradition should be about at its best, what should be central and core to us. And much like the pope is reminding the Catholic Church that the poor and that love for all people and that not marginalizing people is central, we have our forefathers and foremothers that reminded us that justice is an important goal to keep our eyes on. Again and again lately, I have thought of Theodore Parker, Unitarian minister from 1810 to 1850, died at the age of 49. There are two quotations that are really from Parker that are woven into the Oval Office carpet that surround President Obama every day as he goes about his work. Parker doesn't get credit for those two quotations because they're from Dr. King and Abraham Lincoln, but they have Parker's words. And these are some of those words that I want you to hear fresh this morning as I close. Parker wrote, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but a little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends toward justice." Friends, let us tug at that moral arc of the universe. May we join with the Pope and anyone who says that the poor and the marginalized should be at the center of our love, that people should be before dogma and doctrine. May that always be true. Amen.